And welcome to House of Comments. It's a rather packed week. So packed, in fact, we had to cull stories, cut stories, push stories back. We've got all sorts to discuss today. So I'm pleased as ever that I'm Charlotte Henry and she is Emma Burnell. Hello.
Hello.
Happy, very cold, possibly sunny Friday.
It is sunny. It is definitely cold.
It's both those things. We're here to warm the hearts of our listeners. Although actually we've got a hell of a lot of depressing stories to discuss, really, so we might not.
Charlotte, not to completely derail things immediately, what is a cockle when it comes to a heart? Because I don't know what a cockle is when it comes to being like a little whelk, but...
I don't know, but I'm not Googling it.
Yeah, you might get all sorts.
I'm not Googling that. We do have to start... I think it's only appropriate, really, with a little tribute and to John Prescott, who passed away.
Absolutely.
Well, we found out about it Thursday morning, early hours of Thursday morning. A proper big beast of politics in every sense of that phrase.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, he was a fascinating character. He came up through the union movement when doing so was far less professionalised, if you know what I mean. So he came up through it from the shop floor or the boat shore, I suppose.
Yeah, I was going to say, wasn't it the boat floor? Yeah.
And his politics were fascinating in terms of internal labour. He's kind of a little bit on the old Labour right, which is the bit of the right that cared about the union movement, whereas the new Labour right really, really didn't. But he was also, you know, originally very left wing, was always seen as Tony Blair's left wing conscience, the voice of, you know, the working class within the new, much more middle class new Labour government. And a character and a real I mean, he was interestingly a real communicator whilst also being famously a garbled communicator.
Yeah, I saw a clip of Alistair Campbell talking about this. Alistair Campbell joked that one time John Prescott came off TV, asked him how it was. He said, "Well, that was the longest sentence I've ever seen without a verb in it." you know, words to that effect, which you can sort of imagine. But Campbell also made the point that people would still know exactly what Prescott had meant.
Absolutely. And frankly, New Labour could have done with fewer verbiage. The verbs were not New Labour's problem.
No, by definitely. Yeah, absolutely. We, of course, have to talk about the punch just briefly because we can't do a John Prescott conversation with her.
I feel so sorry for him. He said, didn't he, in an interview recently, "I'm really worried that when I die, all that anyone's going to talk about is the punch." And of course, that's exactly what's happening.
I have to say, if someone threw an egg at me, I think I'd punch them as well.
I mean, I think that's exactly where the general public landed.
Well, apparently that was right. So again, in this Alistair Campbell clip, the driver and the special branch agent he was in the car with whilst discussing this, I guess, with Tony Blair on the phone. They obviously overheard the part of the conversation where they said, "Oh, do we have to sack Prescott?" And apparently the driver and the special branch agent both looked back at them and said, "What? Sack him." Yeah. And then they decided at that point that they really did not need to sack him.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think, look, hitting voters is not a great idea. I wouldn't actively encourage it. Certain Labour MPs of recent weeks might have wanted to take that advice. But it was quite clearly and absolutely instinctual. Someone's just smacked me in the face, I'm smacking back. And I think that the general public kind of totally were like, yeah, of course.
I also have to say, if there was anyone in politics of that period I wasn't going to start a fight, physical fight with, John Prescott would have been quite high up that list.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was a boxer.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think the farmer who hit him knew what he was getting into, to be quite honest.
It was an egg, wasn't it? They threw an egg, which was...
We didn't so much throw an egg as smack an egg into his face. Because if you look how close they were, I think throwing would be a poor choice of
a bit generous.
Yeah. But But yeah, that was what happened.
But that's, just one moment aside. You talked about him as Tony Blair's left-wing conscience. I think there was also this idea of him as the sort of, I think you alluded to this as well, the sort of working class voice around an increasingly posh cabinet table. And that was a
Yes.
very important role. And what I wanted to get to with you before I determinedly get us put at least one personal interaction story out of you is, who fulfills that role now? The person that everyone suggests and has been suggested over the last 24 hours or so is Angela Rayner.
Yeah, absolutely. Ange is John in heels, isn't she? She's fabulous.
That's a terrifying image. And I have to say, when I said to Emma, texted Emma, who is the John Prescott of today? And Emma replied, oh, I think it's got to be Ange. It took me a good 20 seconds to re make me realize she wasn't talking about the Tottenham manager. I had to process it and
We have very different thought processes.
instinctive reactions. So yeah, you do think it's Angela Rayner.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, she even has the same role,
Correct, yeah.
not just in terms of the elected deputy leader, but also in terms of her brief is a not dissimilar to what one to the one that Prescott had when he was first in
And
government.
she formally has the title of Deputy Prime Minister, like John
She
Prescott.
does, yeah. Yeah.
Which, let's get back to her. For John Prescott to have come from his beginnings to have ended up with the title of Deputy Prime Minister, I do think it's worthy of taking a minute to step back and appreciate, actually.
Absolutely. He came from very humble beginnings. He was working class through and through, and working class in that like what most working class people are like, rather than what some middle class think working class people are like and should be like. So, he was of the you wear a suit to your job if you're deputy prime minister. And yes, I'm wearing a jag, and yes, Pauline's hair needs protecting because it looks lovely. And that is, I mean, the phrase "salt of the earth" kind of springs to mind. He could be a curmudgeonly bastard, like by all accounts. He wasn't particularly clubbable. He was very tribally Labour, but he was very tribally Labour without being tribalist factionalist,
That's
particularly.
interesting.
He was. Party unity first. Get into government, get things done. Get things done for the people I care about, which was the working class.
He always gave the impression, again, I can't imagine I agreed with much of him with him on politics, but he was a sort of doer, wasn't he?
He was absolutely a doer. And if you look at his record, an awful lot of the things that were done, I mean, he was part of creating the Kyoto Agreement. For
Right.
example,
Well, I mean, everyone, it's really interesting. Sorry to interrupt, but everyone thinks now that climate change and the environment is a airy-fairy middle-class concern. Prescott, as I understand it, was really passionate about it.
really passionate about it because he understood quite rightly that A, the people who will be on the sharpest end of the poor effects of climate change will be the poorest, both internationally, obviously, because those who live in the more equatorial regions will see more damage from temperature increases, but also in the UK as well. But also that there is a massive opportunity in reinvigorating the British manufacturing sector if we become the leaders in creating these technologies. And that was something that in the 90s was kind of disputed, I think, a little. Are we going to be this just a knowledge economy? But the heartlands, the places like Hull, where we represented for 40 years, have been so devastated by the way that Thatcher closed the pits. Prescott wasn't for going backwards. He was not saying, let's go back to coal. He was saying, let's give the communities that once dug coal something new to be proud of.
Yeah, I'm just pleased that you mentioned Kyoto because I think there's sometimes when we talk about John Prescott and figures like him, it's a rather patronizing way of looking at them that they sort of were a bit, salt of the earth, as you put it, kind of just scrapping around in the UK, where actually he was in oftentimes actually in the highest levels of international politics as well. So I'm pleased you mentioned that. I can't let this end without getting at least one Emma Bunnell interaction with John Prescott story.
Well, I'll give you my first ever interaction with him. When I was, I think I was 17, maybe 19, I can't remember exactly. I interned at the Labour Party, at the Labour Party head office. I worked for Tom Watson, who was then sort of middle manager somewhere in the organisation. He paid me £10 a day expenses because this is well before anyone thought of paying interns. And he gave me £20 on Friday so I could have a nice weekend. I've never forgotten that. And I turned up on my first day to Elephant and Castle Tube Station and realised that I could just about work out where Woolworth Road was, but I had no
So,
idea where Labour HQ was.
let's pause for listeners not in London. Arriving at Elephant and Castle Station is a bit like arriving in like Chicago O'Hare Airport or like the middle
Yeah.
of like you do not know which direction you're going in, you don't know which
There are
exit is.
lots of entrances, and unlike most tube stations, those entrances aren't all in the same place where you go that way or that way.
No.
It's like, do you go to that entrance, or that entrance? At that point, there was one still in the shopping centre.
It is like an absolute maze, that place.
Absolutely. It's got two concurrent roundabouts. That's all you need to know about
Right.
Elephant and Castle. Anyway, so I got myself to Woolworth Road.
Impressive in itself.
But there wasn't like a big sign that said, this is Labour HQ. Luckily, there was one politician that I recognised on the street having just done a TV interview. So I sort of waited for the TV people to go away and then went up to John Prescott and said, in my sort of nervous teenage way, excuse me, do you know where the Labour HQ is? And he just looked at me like I was a complete idiot and said, it's there, love, and pointed at the building we were standing in front of.
Perfect.
So it was classic John, both curmudgeonly and helpful at the same time.
I love it. There is a very funny bit in Tony Blair's book, but I also think sums up a point you made about John Prescott being very partisan but not factional, which is in Tony Blair's book, he recalls John Prescott marching around the cabinet table at a height of the time where there was talk about a Lib Lab pact. He recalls Prescott marching around, looking in the corners for, I think it must have been Paddy Ashdow. Going, where's bloody Paddy? Looking, trying to find him, if, as if Blair had hidden him in, which kind of I think sums it up as well.
Well, that doesn't surprise me at all because, particularly at that point, one of the tensions would have been, the Lib Dems were incredibly, they were, middle class, and were skewed to more middle class areas where, of course, they agreed with Tony Blair. And there's lots of talk about how Tony Blair and Paddy Ashdown agreed on loads of things. But that does forget the whole union aspect of Labour's existence, the whole kind of therefore the working class aspect. And I can absolutely imagine Prescott having none of that.
Yeah, I'm sure it was Ashton. It might, because I don't remember with Min Campbell in the leadership it
Well,
being
it was
such
a
a.
no, because I think by the time of Campbell, that kind of close working had pretty much fallen
I
apart.
think so. So it must have been Paddy Ashton that John
Yeah,
Prescott was
yeah.
hunting around for. We have a whole bunch. I mean, I'm glad we got a moment to talk about that because I think he's a quite a. I'm not sure they make them like John Prescott anymore. Let's leave it at that. But we do have to turn to international affairs because there's a couple of huge, huge international stories, which of course the UK government will have to respond to. We'll start with the International Criminal Court, which has issued arrest warrants for Hamas leader Deif and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former Defence Minister Golan. Let's just get, actually, I'm going to dismiss why I think it's so ridiculous out of hand, which is that the token point to the wrongdoing of Hamas is the only arrest warrant they've put for is someone who is almost certainly dead. He was almost certainly killed in July. I mean, it's just complete nonsense that it's just a cover for going after the Israeli prime politicians. It's a nonsense. And then the other sort of rather farcical mistake, the Warren against the Israeli politicians says from the 8th of October. Well, nothing was happening on the 8th of October, apart from Israel still trying to work out how many people had been massacred, raped, killed, and kidnapped. So the idea that they're worrying from the 8th of October is also nonsensical. I just think that this is so isolated. And I think it genuinely makes peace harder because, if nothing else, it makes travel and in-person interactions harder. We've already seen, for example, the Dutch foreign ministers. Trip to Israel has been cancelled by the Israeli foreign minister because they're so angry about the response of the Dutch to this. The other farcical thing about this is that Israel is not even part of the ICC, and no, nor is the US. So there's going to be no practical implication for this. It is, it's just a posturing thing, an anti-Israel posturing thing that I think makes peace a lot harder, and also, frankly, equates. Democratic leaders to terrorists, and I think it's pretty shameful, actually.
Well, as you know, I disagree with you. I was thinking because we've had lots of online and offline conversations about how to deal with this issue because it is very emotive. And I wanted to lay out where we agree before I come on to where I disagree with everything that you've just said, because otherwise it will just sound like I'm just taking the oppositional position. I think we agree on the fact that. I mean, who couldn't agree with, I mean, people do, but they're idiots, that what happened on October the 7th was extraordinary and horrific, and that it should never be forgotten that that is the start of this phase of this long-running conflict, dispute, whatever you want to call it. Secondly, I think we're both in agreement that Israel had every right to respond to what happened on October the 7th. Their border had been crossed, their people had been slaughtered and sexually abused, and you in a world where pacifism is a lovely idea, but takes two to tango and not to tango, as it were. You have to accept that when those things happen, a state has every right to act. Where I think our level of disagreement is on how Israel has reacted, some of the measures that have been taken, the fact that it does feel like collective punishment. And what the role of international law is in that. I think that if I agree with you about putting October the 8th in there, that seems completely stupid. I don't know enough about the intricacies of international law to make a judgment on the merits of the case, but. What they're saying is that starvation is being used as collective punishment against the people of Gaza. And certainly it is the case that, for example, the US said you have to let 300 aid trucks in a day, and we're seeing fewer than 100 going in. People are starving. And if we believe, as I do, in a system of international law, then nobody should be above that. And that includes states who are our allies, as well as states who are our enemies, as well as terrorists, which is quite clearly what Hamas is. So ultimately, if it is the case that these decisions have either through negligence or deliberate action led to the collective punishment of the Palestinian people, then that is a crime. It is a crime against international law, and that the people who are responsible for that need to be held accountable.
It's not for you and I, thank goodness. to litigate in international law. I do want to pick up on this point about collective punishment because it is a phrase that's used a lot, and I think it simplifies something that is far more complex. Look, obviously, innocent civilians in Gaza are in the most horrific situation as a result of that. Well, that's an indisputable fact. I think the phrase collective punishment ignores, and I think therefore this ICC approach ignores the use of Hamas of those poor civilians as human shields, which we know is happening. We know they are embedded in what was, because obviously, tragically, there is not much of that infrastructure left anymore. Civilian infrastructure in Gaza. We know Hamas embedded themselves through that. We think possibly hostages were held in things like hospitals. I mean, so I find that phrase collective punishment not accurate because I think Hamas is putting its own people in harm's way. As to the point about aid, which is hugely, hugely important, and obviously more aid needs to get in, but the problem is we're also seeing aid trucks looted as they're on their way in. 97 trucks were looted just the other day, and I don't think it was Israelis who were doing the looting. I just wanted your take on my point about how this actually might hinder peace. We've already seen Emily Thornberry, the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, say that if Netanyahu lands in Britain, there's no choice but to have him arrested. Well, that means he won't be able to travel here. The only places he will be able to travel, or will want to travel, is to the US. I'm not sure that is a particularly good state of affairs.
Yes, Hamas have embedded themselves in civilian populations. That was known before those civilian populations were attacked. Yes, it makes it a lot harder for anyone to go after Hamas, but that doesn't mean that both sides aren't responsible for the care of those civilian populations, the people who are using them as shields and the people who are battering those shields. So I think yes, I agree that it's an appalling tactic of Hamas's, but I don't agree that therefore it can be ignored what is happening to them.
Oh no, I don't want to ignore it at all. I feel that actually, by many standards, the Israeli forces are, and we've seen military experts say this, are taking due care. But it's an almost impossible situation unless you just want to leave and leave Hamas to it.
Well, I mean, I think there's again, not a military expert, but when we've seen people being moved to northern Gaza and then those camps being bombed, I would say that doesn't feel like due care. I think we agree completely on the humanitarian necessity. Again, like war is difficult and complicated, and yes, there will be looting, but there are also huge barriers being set up to the kinds of organizations like World Central Kitchen, like the UN Refugees Agency, that by the Israeli forces that make it harder and harder and harder to get any aid in, and that's just not acceptable to me. And then I'm trying to remember your last point. Sorry, there's so much of it.
Oh no, I was just
On
wanted
the
to.
travel thing,
Yeah.
yeah, that is what the practical implication of this. It will make it harder for Netanyahu to visit any country that is a signatory to the ICC because they would, at least in theory, be subject to an arrest warrant. The second they touch down on, say, British soil, which is where this comes in probably to our conversation more, because that's the British politics element of it. How will the Starmer government respond to this ruling? But again, I think if the ICC believes that there is significant enough evidence that this is a deliberate tactic or at the worst, a negligently ignored tactic, then what are you going to do? Say, oh, well, it's really bad that this person did a crime because they can't like go and talk about not doing the crime in the future. I mean, that's just not how legality works.
Yeah, and I'm obviously coming to a point where I sincerely don't accept, look, again, not only international law expert, but I find the situation in Gaza deeply, deeply depressing. I absolutely lay the blame for that on Hamas for the attack of October the 7th. You said yourself, and you're totally right, no country would accept what had happened then without a response. And that is.
I absolutely, absolutely agree with that. The Israelis had every right to respond. Where I think our variance is how broad the allowance of that response should be.
Yeah, the thing about that is, I think that's all very easy for us to say sitting here. For young soldiers on the ground in Gaza, it is almost an impossible situation. Now, I think some of that might be why, there was huge, obviously, unity in Israel at the beginning. I think because of the failure of the Netanyahu government to bring back the hostages, I think public support, is really seeping in some places. Look, when I was in Israel not all that long ago, it's very clear that in Jerusalem there's one mood and in Tel Aviv there is another. And Israel is a small but very diverse country. So, and you, having grown up where you did in London, know the joke about two Jews, three opinions. So, all that as a given.
I mean, to be fair, where I grew up, because there was a very Orthodox community, but also a much broader non-Orthodox community as well, it was more like two Jews, three different ways of practicing.
Well, quite. Only three, and you did well. But you mentioned the point actually about the British government, which is really important to our listeners in this show. I have to say, the initial sounds have been a bit pathetic. They don't seem to have got their ducks in a row on this. You've got Starmer, obviously, his instincts are to comply with international law. That's obviously his instincts. He obviously also realizes the sort of diplomatic implications of that. As I mentioned, the Israelis have already sent back the Dutch foreign minister. It looks like there were reports on Sky News this morning that the Israelis will not deal with the French when it comes to discussing Lebanon because of the French approach to the war in general, not just this ICC warrant. I've already seen some of the loony left talking further about arms embargoes and stopping arms sales to Israel, which doesn't have that much impact on Israel,
No,
but
our arms
is.
sales to Israel are minuscule. That would be a tokenistic
It's
gesture.
tokenistic, yeah.
But on the other, I mean, if it's a tokenistic gesture, then either side can probably go, you know what, that one we'll let go so that we can continue other talks.
I doubt that would happen, but yes, maybe. The other thing that I find so grotesque about this, and I have tried to avoid whataboutery for most of this conversation, but I do find it quite grotesque that Benjamin Netanyahu, for all I dislike him, is a subject of an ICC arrest warrant while Putin and Assad and they're like, carry on. I find that
Well,
pretty.
Putin is also subject to
I don't
such an
believe
arrest warrant.
so.
No, he is. Someone was tweeting about this morning.
I find it all pretty grotesque, the double standards.
Well, as I say, I don't know that there is a double standard there. Assad should absolutely be. I don't know
There you
if he is
go.
or not, but I believe Putin is subject to
I
ICC.
don't believe so, but I would hope so. I'd love to
But
be wrong.
yeah. On the 17th of March 2023, following investigation of war crimes against humanity and genocide, the International Criminal Court is arrested, issued arrest warrants for Vladimir Putin.
Oh, thank goodness.
So there you go.
But we don't think Assad.
So Bashar Assad is subject to an international arrest warrant, but I don't know that it's the ICC.
No, I don't think it is, which again, I think adds to this whole sort of sense that the ICC is a bit farcical and a. Particularly given that, as I say, the only Hamas leader that they've managed to get a warrant for has probably been dead for months, which I think, to my mind, just about sums it all up.
I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you that there should be much greater sanctions on Hamas for what they did, but I disagree that that means there shouldn't be sanctions on Netanyahu.
To end the point, I don't mean to cut in and get the last word, but I do want to make this point. I think what this incident and others like it have done is make Israel and therefore the Jewish diaspora feel completely gaslit and isolated. And I think people are underestimating the effect of that.
So I'm going to say two things on that. One where I agree with you, and one where I think I, not that I disagree with you, because I'm not going to tell you how people feel, but there is an awful lot of work being done in the UK and elsewhere to separate the notion that criticism of Israel or the behaviour of Israel is the responsibility of British Jews. So a lot of the awful rise in anti-Semitic incidents that we've seen is justified by some, completely wrongly, obviously, as, yeah, but look at what Israel are doing. And the response to that, quite rightly, from all of the organizations that fight anti-Semitism is that British Jews are not responsible for the actions of Israel. And that's true and right. And therefore, I think that when the leaders of Israel are held responsible for those actions, and you and I have a difference of opinion over whether that's right or wrong. While I am sure you're right, and you're much more likely to know than I am, that diaspora Jews feel that they are isolated as a result of that, I would hope that the flip side of diaspora Jews are not responsible for the actions of Israel should also mean that criticism of Israel or the injunctions against Israel are not seen as, or should not be seen as, however much they are seen as, a an isolation of British Jewry or the diaspora Jewry. So that's kind of, I mean, it's a subtle nuanced point, and I'm sure that kind of intellectualizing of it doesn't happen in the gut at all. But I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah, not doesn't really reflect the conversations I've been having
No,
over
I'm
the
sure
last
it
24 hours.
doesn't.
But anyway, we
But
have to.
and as I say, there's a difference between what intellectualizing it and emotionalizing it. But I think if as quite rightly, we attack anyone who attacks British Jewry because they think they're doing something standing up for Palestinians against Israel, I think that has to go both ways.
Yeah, as I say, all I know is the increasingly distressed conversations I've had over the last 20, not just 11 months, but 24 hours. Just to keep on the happy state of the world, we're going to quickly head to Ukraine, where there has been a slight shift in approach from both the UK, France, and the United States in letting some long-range weaponry be fired, as an attack against.
Into Russia.
Into Russia, exactly. It's been attack as opposed to defense, which is there was always quite strict rules before that. Now, we're not launching American missiles at Moscow. They've restricted where that can
It's
be,
Kursk, isn't it?
just the Kursk region, exactly. But it's a slight shift. I've seen arguments, people saying that, well, that's bad move because you've just removed a Donald Trump. One of the cards Donald Trump can play. I've seen other people saying, why the hell didn't this happen months and months ago? I'm probably more in the why didn't this happen months and months
Yeah,
ago
and
camp.
Zelensky's been pushing for it for months. The justification is that Russia changed the rules of the game by bringing in the North
North
Korean
Korean troops, yeah.
troops. I think that that's a good smokescreen for the fact that Biden wanted to get this done before he went out, in order to strengthen Zelensky's hand at the inevitable negotiating table set up by Trump.
Sure. That seems to be what was going on to me. I think they've all realised. And then once the United States did it, the other world powers realised they had to follow suit a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly, I think, what I mean. It is still the case that the United States leads this kind of policy,
For sure.
and everybody else kind of follows. We shall see if that's still the case in 4 years' time.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't have time to go through the never-ending spiral of Donald Trump's nominations, withdrawn nominations.
First out the gates.
I had a much worse joke to make, so I'm really pleased you went with that one first. For me, the one that has stood out is former W, you know, the WWE boss, Linda McMahon, is now going to be the education secretary. Incredible scenes.
Jesus.
Absolutely incredible scenes. Anyway, there's so much going on in the world. We've talked for far too long. So just if people need more of you, Emma, where can they keep up with you?
So you can read my newsletter, which is Hard Thinking on the Soft Left on Substack. I am now more on Blue Sky than I'm on anything else, and I'm just Emma Bunnell on Blue Sky.
I'm at Charlotte A. Henry across social media, including Blue Sky. Please head over to theaddition.net for my musings on culture, media, and sport, that kind of area. Of course, if you want more from us, and why wouldn't you? Please head over to patreon.com/houseofcommentspodcast. It means you get extra episodes of our podcast. We did a one on the farmers on Monday. That was quite fun. We've got a paid episode of that. We put all these episodes there as well. And you get both our newsletters for a mere fiver a month. We're basically spoiling you. So that's patreon.com/houseofcommentspodcast if you want to support the show that way. And we will probably love you a lot.
We not there's no probably
There's no
about it,
probably
Charlotte.
about it. There's no probably about it. Fair enough. That's patreon.com/houseofcommentspodcast. Thank you so much. And we'll see you next week.